has conquered something. It was not only a large wedding, but it was a thoroughly westernized wedding. The only eastern part was the wedding cake, which was in the form of a Buddhist pagoda. But to get through to the wedding was quite a problem. There were hours of smiles that had to be gone through first. Smiling and bowing. They probably were averaging probably 600 or 700 bows an hour when I left. These bows must have been tremendous from the standpoint of reduction programs. They would undoubtedly keep a good waistline. But everyone was bowing and smiling. There was no handshaking. This was a little too conventional. But everyone met everyone else with a very solicitous consideration for age, for the patterns of life, for relationships, and everyone was bowing and smiling from ear to ear. It was a wonderful occasion. And in the East, anything that is possible to celebrate is celebrated. They have feasts, and ceremonies and rituals and festivities every day of the year. Morning till night, all the time, there is something to be grateful for. Here we just can't find anything worth enduring. Yet we have much more than they have. But they have this one thing that seems to be important, and that is that little garden or that quiet place. Like the shrine on the top of the department store. When you get through shopping, you'll go up and pray a little while and get your nerves put together again. Then you go back and assail the basement bargain shop again. Bargains begin and end with prayer, by which it means everyone is happy. The sumo wrestling championships were on. And as most of you know, these massive persons represent a kind of wrestling or athletics unknown in the West. A tremendous championship bout that lasts 10 seconds. In the course of the championships, while these massive mountains of muscle were locked in what appeared to be deadly conflict, the camera of the television showed close-ups of the faces of these struggling men. Here they were locked in a to-the-death championship. And the close-up showed both of them smiling cherubically. There wasn't the slightest look of tension or animosity on them. They looked like innocent little children smiling benignly at each other while locked in this struggle for championship. When it was finally decided and the camera showed the winner and the loser, the smiles on both were exactly the same. There was no way of telling by the man's demeanor whether he had won or lost. They asked one of the champions about this on the count of strangers present. Well, he said, we always smile. If we are smiling and have lost, we are smiling because a good man has won. If we smile and win, we are smiling because heaven has been kind to us. But there's always a reason to rejoice. Even a loss should not interfere with our being grateful that we have been good sports, we have done the best we could, that's all there is to it. This is unfathomable to Western man, who's got to put all he has behind something and come out a complete wreck. Tension in this kind of living naturally tears us very much and leaves us without too many resources against tomorrow with its new burdens. So let us at least try to gain a small lesson from perhaps our Eastern neighbors who have some rather interesting things that they can share with us. And one is to work for this childlike way of acceptances in life. A way of life in which We are not unhappy because of burdens. We have only one reason to be unhappy, and that is if burdens make us unhappy. Then there's something wrong with us. But we are not to be miserable because someone else has more than we have. That others should have more is very fortunate for them, and we should rejoice for them. It just doesn't occur to us that there is always some way of adjusting the mind so that it takes the hurt out of our own thoughts, that we are no longer desperately injuring ourselves. The moment we fall into negativity, we begin to think of unfairness. We begin to grumble that someone is more fortunate than we are, and this is an unhappy situation. But in a Buddhist country, this is not an unhappy situation. It simply indicates that the other person has earned something that we haven't earned, and we rejoice for it, and hope that his example will inspire us to earn likewise. In the West, we are jealous of him. We feel that he has no right to these things. And one of the reasons that this feeling has increased with us is because we have lost a concept of universal justice. Western man no longer believes in a universe that is controlled by a divine plan. To us, in the Western world, the universe is anybody's opportunity. And we resent the individual who steps forward and makes more of this opportunity. It never occurs to us to realize that there is a plan, and that this plan has to be obeyed, and that we have to learn to obey it. We have not any longer any faith in the integrities of things. We have no faith that our own good deeds will ever be rewarded, therefore we are not very much concerned in maintaining them. We believe to the moment that it's every man for himself and the devil take the hindmost. And we live this way. And naturally, we are sick, tired, and miserable. In the Zen garden, we become capable of a certain quietude inside ourselves. And if we achieve this quietude, if we once experience it, if for even a few moments we actually can experience peace of soul, if the possible good that can come to us is known to us, even for a few moments, it is as though a wonderful light came through a cloud. The individual who finds this peace in himself is born into a new universe of values. He is born into a better world than he has ever known before. He suddenly discovers that the whole pattern of things is nothing but his own acceptances and his own rejections. That the mad rush of people around him cannot make him happy and cannot make him unhappy unless he takes sides with the wrong group in some way. But actually, regardless of everything, we are all free until we become enslaved to an attitude. And then we cannot liberate ourselves again. We none of us ever have an enemy until we make one. And we never have an adversary till we acknowledge him. We are all of us creating these psychic intensities which bog us down. And there is really no reason for them. We have to gain the strength, however, to live as people before we can overcome this. As long as we are afraid of public opinion, we must remain stupid in order to enjoy the high respect of others. But when we no longer care, and no longer are willing to be miserable simply because it is fashionable, then we can see through these patterns into something different and better. We have a wonderful kind of life of our own. This life is always available to us. We are sculptors. We can fashion it as we will. We are master architects. We can create the structure of our own pattern of existence exactly as we will. There are only two provisos. One is that what we will must be right, must be essentially proper, or else the creation of it will cause harm, and this harm will hurt us. But assuming that the thing we want to do is reasonable and proper, we have the right to do it. And every individual has the right at any moment to give up any attitude that hurts him. If anger has worried you and injured you and disturbed you for a lifetime, there is never a moment in which you cannot renounce it. There is not a time in life when any fault or failing that we possess has to be maintained. Sometimes we may say that if we shift our point of view somewhere in the midst of life, it will upset the pattern of our ways. But most persons' patterns of ways are so bad that they can well stand upsetting. We will all be better for it. The fact that we have nagged for 20 years has no reason why we have to nag even once more. If we have worried ourselves and our friends and our relatives and our neighbors and our enemies into decline for the best part of a lifetime, we do not have to continue this. Even one more worry must be decided on by ourselves. The moment we refuse to maintain that which is no good, we are free from it. Tension is always associated with negations, with preserving or maintaining things that are not good. How can we look over life, even in our own small spheres of personal influence, and not be aware of the fact? How can we study our own health patterns without accepting the effect of our attitudes upon our health? How can we overlook the fact that negative or destructive attitudes always make life less attractive for us as well as for other people? How can we overlook the fact that the moment we relax away from wrong attitudes, we cease to build tensions? Nature will not automatically destroy the habits we have built up. Tensions are habitual in our way of life. Our parents had them and their parents had them. The story of Western man is a story of 2,500 years of tension, with over 2,000 wars during that period of time as monuments to tension. Nature will not take this tension and wash it off as it might clean the slate marks off of a blackboard. Nature will continue to build up habit patterns because nature is like that. Yet with every habit pattern that is wrong, nature steps in with a consequence that is painful. Thus nature is forever reminding us that any destructive attitude we have is wrong, and we must stop it. Now, people insist that the correction of these problems is stupendous. I've heard people say, yes, that's true. I know I shouldn't be jealous of Jones, but I am. And every time I think of Jones, I'm jealous of him again. I know I shouldn't. But how do I stop? Jones has things I want. I think I'm more entitled to them than Jones is. I think Jones is a person who is too lucky. And so the person says, I have ability and Jones has the luck. So I'm jealous of Jones. Another individual says, certainly I don't like my relatives. I have good reason to. They never liked me. Why should I like them? You go to one of Jones's relatives and you say, well, why don't you like Jones? He says that you don't like him. And the relative says that you ever live with Jones. So everybody ends up by accusing everyone else of being the cause for the discomfort. The simple matter is, it's got to break somewhere. The first individual who realizes that this liking is wrong is the one with whom rests the correction. It has to move in and make the adjustment. And usually when one person in a complex of that kind straightens himself out, all the rest of the problem falls apart. It is all being maintained by one storm center. And if this relaxes, the blizzard is over. So in all these things, the question is how to get over them. And the Oriental mind suggests the garden again. Just go off somewhere by yourself and be quiet. Relax. Look around you and see a world of wonders, a world of miracles, a world of infinite life everywhere manifested. Listen to the song of the birds and watch the tiny creeping and crawling things upon the earth, each fulfilling their destiny for reasons that they do not understand or have never conceived of. Think of how you take all the rocks in the world and toss them together and you make a mountain. And when some vast volcanic strategy creates such a peak, ages to come say, how beautiful is this mountain? Formed out of some terror of nature, in itself a thing of loveliness forever. Everywhere in the universe, wisdom. Everywhere light and life. Everywhere creatures fulfilling purposes, either consciously or unconsciously. And in this quietude, in this peacefulness of things, who is man that thou shouldst be mindful of him? What is man in all of this except another one of these marvelous creatures? Man wasn't fashioned to conquer the world. He was fashioned to relax and enjoy the wonder of creation, sharing with life all of the splendor of life itself. Man couldn't in the beginning enjoy all these things because, like the infant, he didn't understand. He did not know. He groped after some grasp or concept of existence. But now he is several millions of years tired. He has lived here a long time. He has left monuments of history and literature and culture. He has lived here long enough to live better than he does. He has enough philosophy, enough insight, enough religion, enough culture and art to create a far better world for himself than he has ever built. Why doesn't he build it? Why does he go on desperately perpetuating the jungle when he is a creature who has outgrown the jungle? Well, perhaps it's because he's thoughtless. Because he has never actually oriented himself to life. He has never really grown up to the point where he realizes that he never can own anything. That his own existence is passing. That he is here for a day. That he cometh forth as a flower that's cut down. Because the pattern of his existence, every inducement is for man to live well while he's here. And by living well, it means to live richly in himself. And why should he sacrifice this possibility of a beautiful hour of contemplation or some strange distorted process, such as trying to build a corporation. Why should he have this type of thing when the same wisdom which he now so strangely uses, if it were properly used, would give him the securities he needs without the terrible tension, stress, and conflict which he has built? It is perfectly possible for the wisdom of man to give him security without hate, to give him progress without death, to give him the unfoldment of his own character without conflict, without fear and anxiety, jealousy and envy, and criticism and condemnations. These things are unnecessary. Man is a better thing than this. He has a better purpose. And sitting quietly by the side of a little waterfall in a Zen garden, watching golden carp flashing in the pool, perhaps the individual can suddenly restore his citizenship in a natural existence. A natural existence which is intended to provide him with time to sit by that pool, and to learn to understand the golden carp that swim in that pool. For in the beauty of the afternoon, the flowers, and the growth of natural things, come the rewards that bring with them no pain, no stress, no anxiety. The individual can have friends. He can live a simple, useful, unfolding life of inner nobility. He can write great poetry and great drama. He can compose great music. He can find countless ways to live well. Cottage industry has proven itself in Asia as a tremendous thing. Man can produce what he needs, create what is necessary to him. He does not have to hope and believe that he must sometime leave an empire behind him. If he only was thinking more of the future before him and not the empire behind him, we would get along much better. We would have the courage to protect happiness, which now we do not have. Today, happiness is the first and most expendable of all things. And for the sake of ambition or greed or a little selfishness, we are perfectly willing to sacrifice it at any moment. The Zen concept perhaps doesn't enable Western man to quit his job and live by the side of a pool, or experience the quiet joys of Thoreau on the shores of Walden. But the Zen concept can help Western man to adjust a little better to the place where he already is. It can help him to live in the world he is in. It can bring him a little more contentment with his job. It can give him a certain sense of value in simple and direct things. Perhaps it can help parents to be less nervous with their children, to recognize that there's something important in being good parents and not in trying to find a good babysitter. Everywhere, quiet thoughtfulness produces solution, and quiet thoughtfulness relaxes tension. Now, there are tensions that come also from vast collective circumstances of life. Now, there are tensions that are almost inevitable to man. Man has one tension which probably will be very difficult for him to overcome, and that is tension of insecurity about himself. Man is always in the presence of his own dissolution. He never knows when in a second all this pattern of life which he is struggling with will dissolve into emptiness. He never knows in what moment he will vanish away from the patterns to which he has become associated. Instead of this impermanence of himself regulating his conduct, it has become his great anxiety. instead of adjusting to the absolute certainty of change, he builds every defense against this change and fights it to the bitter end, fully knowing that he must lose. This struggle, therefore, against the passing of himself has caused a great deal of psychic stress. It causes ambition to curdle. The individual to say to himself, I must make it in 5 years or 10 years, or it is too late. So man who is born to understand eternity becomes hopelessly tied up with a few dates on a watch which he wears. He becomes completely locked in time. He becomes the victim of the realization of his own transitoriousness, that he cannot survive. Therefore, he must hasten. But if he cannot survive, if he cannot endure, why hasten? Because all he is doing is forcing a situation which can never be permanent anyway. If the goal is such that it cannot be meaningful unless it is achieved immediately, then it is not worth achieving at all. The individual will sometime find that through the pressures of society, through the collapse of empires, through the rising tides of political and social change, the man must ultimately return to the simpleness of knowing that he is here for the good that he can do. He is here for the happiness that he can share. The most important things in this world are the kindly things that we can do for each other, the gentle wisdom we can share, the pleasures of protection we can give. There's nothing in all of success that can bring to the individual as much happiness as a kindly, well-organized home. Here, where friends can work and live together in an atmosphere of affection, the members find fulfillment. Fulfillment that is greater than any success can ever bring. Yet one by one, these members of a happiness renounce their birthrights and go out in search of this strange, ethereal, insecure thing called success, giving up the real joy of existence for a pain that must eat at their souls as long as they live. What is the value of it all? What is there wrong under such condition? With seeking a quietude beyond life, seeking to build within the self this peacefulness, which enables the person to do all the things that need doing, but never to dramatize or emotionalize them. Zen on this is nothing but a strict and immediate honesty. Zen says to you, you do not have to like the people you do not like, but you do not need to pretend. If you have nothing in common with the individual, your lives will separate. Unless someone makes false values and tries to hold together that which has no cohesive element within itself. It is not necessary to dislike anything. It is not particularly necessary to like anything. What is essentially necessary is to quietly accept life. Accept the values of it. The immediate responsibility that comes at hand, perform it. For there is very little to it in most cases. There's the story of a Zen monk when a community adopted a little boy who had left orphan. And the child was very small when adopted. The old monk had to find all kinds of ways to feed the baby and take care of the child. And in the course of time, the child grew up. And finally, the monk had a grown man on his hands. And the child was no relative of the monk. And one day, the child came to the monk and said, Reverend Father, I realize, having now achieved maturity, how great a thing you have done. Here I am no relation of yours, yet you have loved me and cared for me and guarded me and provided for me as you would your own son, with no reward, no reason for doing so. But all I can say is that I do understand and that I am grateful. The old monk said, I haven't done anything. I haven't done a thing. I walked along the road, and you were handed to me out of space. What is given to me is mine. What is mine, I will do my best with. When you grow up, you will go your way. I will have lost nothing because I owned nothing. It was my right, my privilege, my duty to do what I could. But this is nothing exceptional. This is only human. What else could a person do who is human? Well, the boy didn't understand that very well, but anyway, the old monk regarded it as just simply a common task. He said if it had been a little dog with a broken leg, I would have done the same. Whatever it is, if we have natural, kindly hearts, we do the things that need doing. And we do not sit back and rationalize them and try to determine whether they are profitable or not. And if this boy had left the old monk with a rebuke and absolutely without gratitude, the old monk would not have been in the slightest annoyed or injured or defeated, nor would he have felt misunderstood. Because if he had had a little dog with a broken leg, and he had set the leg, the dog had gotten well, perhaps in time the dog would have run away also. This is life. Life lives itself. Therefore, there is no debt, there is no problem. But we can dramatize these things and make them terribly important. I know persons who had done much less than the old monk and died of a broken heart because the boy didn't support them for the rest of their lives. There was no gratitude in the universe. There was no fairness. I've given everything I had, nobody cares. There's only one thing we give, and that's everything we have. And there's only one reason to give it, and that is because our heart tells us to. And when we are waiting for reward for it, we have desecrated everything. In the Zen philosophy, then, a man going to work works his hours, and works them faithfully. And he doesn't make more coffee breaks than he should. He isn't out to do as little as he can and get as much as he can. If he is a good Zen man, his primary consideration is that the man who employs him shall be fairly treated. And that if a man pays for a certain task, the man who does that task will perform it honorably. These are the important things, not the great question of how many hours or how many nickels. The point is an obligation. When we hire a man, we are obligated. The hire is obligated to pay. The man hired is obligated to work. If each fulfills his obligation with the right spirit, there is no problem. No dissatisfaction, no hatred, no great conflict between capital and labor. The individuals who work from the heart, who do the things there are to do without regrets, without anxieties, these are the Zen people. They are the people who leave good things after them. And these are the same people who quickly and willingly sacrifice their own pleasure, because they have discovered that when you sacrifice your own pleasure for a greater need, you suddenly discover a greater pleasure than the one you gave up. For the greater the good that is done, the greater the pleasure in the soul of the doer. Everything is compensated. Compensated within ourselves. So there is no need to fear. There is no need to worry that others will not recognize our talents. Not important whether they do or not. The only important thing is the talent. For that alone can survive the grave. It is not important whether we are promoted or not promoted. The old monks of the Diamond Mountains of Korea, the Taoist fathers who really inspired the Zen monks of China and Korea, like to live in very remote places. Sometimes an emperor or a duke or a great man would come and say to the old hermit, "Father, I need a new prime minister. My country's in a bad way. Will you come and govern us?" And the old Taoist monk says, "Well, first of all, tell me, is this an invitation or is this a job?" "Well," the emperor says, "well, I'd put it that way if you want to. I guess this is a job. Well, we really need you." The old monk says, "Well, if there is a need, I will do it. As soon as the need is over, I will retire because I have no interest whatever in being prime minister of anything. Because all that a prime minister gets is hardening of the arteries. And no amount of reward can pay him for the jealousies which are heaped upon him by the ignorant. But if there is something that needs doing for the common good, it shall be done to the best of our ability. But we want no compensation, we want no honors, we want no recognition and no flattery. In order to do this thing, we must have the help of the imperial house. The prime minister cannot bring virtue unless the emperor requires it. Therefore, the emperor must set the example, the prime minister will administer the state, and the people will flourish. But if there's any problem here, if there is any catering to the ministers of state, if there is jealousy and bickering, then run the country yourself. You have no place in it for wise people." This was the opinion of Confucius at an earlier date. So these old monks used to come out of the mountains, run a country for a year, 2 years, 5 years, and then hasten back to their meditations and get over it. They had no interest in power. They had no interest in high office. But they recognized duty. And they realized also that regardless of what the office was, duty demanded they had to perform the action to the very best of their knowledge. There could be no compromise. There could be no sellout. There could be no personal advantages. The only way the wise man could live with himself was to do the best that he could at any moment and at every moment and let the chips fall where they would. This was the Tao way. Later it became the Zen way. It was the way of cutting completely through the involved and complicated knot of circumstances. That where action is direct, where it is arising from immediate experience, where it leads to immediate experience, where the man says, "This needs doing, I will do it," and does it. We then have action without tension. But if the man says, "Yes, I am called to this particular job, but can I afford to take it? Is the salary going to be adequate? Will I lose more friends than I make? Will my family suffer? Will my own future estate be threatened? Would I be better to do it this way or do it that way?" Then the opportunity ends in a conflict of tensions, ulterior motives, self-justifications, and strategies and plots. These are the tension things. Every action that is performed has to be performed because of conviction and because of consciousness. If it is done this way, there are no hangovers. To live this way is probably not to escape all tension, but it is to reduce tension to the minimum. And we can start in with little problems that arise in our own thinking. Get rid of grudges first. There's no time for them. In a world in which atomic fission hangs over all of us, what sense is there feuding with our neighbors? And I get over all feelings of self-pity, because they are meaningless. We can be sorry for ourselves forever, and all we will do is dissolve in our own tears. Nothing is accomplished. If we observe that certain tendencies of ours have always resulted in trouble, correct the tendencies. Correct them immediately. And realize that immediate change is the only kind that is possible. There is never a moment where an individual cannot reform himself. There is never an instant in which he cannot destroy the worst habit that he suffers from. One simple stroke of the will, and he is free of the entanglement. But if he struggles with it, it will be like a seven-headed hydra. At every head he chops off, there will be seven more spring in its place. But by a simple yes and a simple no, the whole structure, a procedure, a formality, a protocol, all these things vanish. Zen is a man of yes and no. When he says yes, he needs it. When he says no, he needs it. And both answers are unchangeable. This is the end of tension. Decision ends a great part of tension. Indecision promotes it forever. The relinquishing of self, which means to get over all insults and all hurts and all griefs and all grievances which exist because of the hypersensitivity of self. This is another wonderful aid to getting over tensions. Actually, the person achieves this end by suddenly experiencing the Zen absence of self. There is no self in us that can afford to be offended. There is no self in us that can afford to brood over real or imaginary ills for one moment. Whatever is inside of ourself is energy, life. And this energy and this life have useful works to do. And all the mumbling and the grumbling is an exhaustion of energy without use. The more we compromise with these grumblings, the more tensions we develop. One of the simplest answers to all these kind of tensions is for the individual to simply laugh at himself. That's where the old Zen monk was a master. The sudden, full, complete, overwhelming realization of the ridiculousness of ourselves. That if we could really see ourselves in our true and native light, we would be stranger and more ludicrous than any cartoon that an artist could devise. A bundle of contradictions tied together with a string of discords. This is man. If we can see this, if we can recognize it, if we can do like the old Zen monk carrying the broom, walking along carrying the broom so that he could sweep himself up whenever the occasion demanded. Realizing that all his likes and dislikes are part of the ridiculousness of existence. That actually, whether he likes a thing or doesn't like it, is of no meaning, either to himself or anybody else. All his elaborate patterns by which he builds up defenses and finds excuses and finds means of supporting attitudes. This doesn't mean a thing. If the attitude is any good, it'll support itself. If it is no good, nothing can support it. Forget these things. Take the attitude of the garden. Sit down and become an observer of existence. And in an observer, as you see things going by that need a helping hand, give it. Never for a moment, however, allow yourself to take this strange, funny world that man has fashioned and let it seem important. It is not important. The only thing is that is important about the world is the part that man did not fashion, the sunrise and the sunsets. the great motions of the ocean, the bursting forth of flowers in spring, nature bearing fruit, and in the winter covering itself with a mantle of shimmering jewels. These things man can observe and contemplate and enjoy. Man can enjoy the nature in his fellow man and in all creatures. Men can sing together and work together, perhaps sometimes weep together. But these things are basically good. They are simple, direct things, and in them there is no tension. The tension is subterfuge, the snicker and the sneer. Tension is artificiality. Tension is the individual trying to create great broken rhythms to bear symbolism to a great broken soul within himself. Tensions are like some strange habit-forming drug. They are ways in which we try to drown the realities which we will not face. It is all actually in life a very quiet, zen mystery. A mystery of little people learning to love each other, learning to like each other in spite of their various natures and appearances, learning to excuse faults, learning to laugh together, learning to find all things that seem serious a little ridiculous, and that all things that seem ridiculous are a little serious. To build a philosophy that enables us to live graciously and exit nobly. These are the problems that Zen works with. To give the person directness. For indirectness is the end of hesitancy. And the doing of the thing that needs doing is the end of this vast buildup of psychological artificial pressures. If a thing needs doing, it needs doing. When the rain falls, it falls, because it is the way of rain. When man comes to a decision, he calls a conference and nothing is done. That is the way of man. And that is why things are in such a sorry fix. Learn to be quiet a little bit in yourself and try to find ways to put yes and no's into all these maybes and perhapses which make up life. When you see situations that are wrong, try to immediately clarify them. Are you wrong? Is the situation wrong? Are you afraid to admit that you have been in fault? Have you maintained an hypocrisy until it can't be endured any longer? You say other people are thoughtless. Have you been thoughtful? You say other people are selfish. Are you unselfish? Face these things very directly. When you face them, solve them. For if the solution comes immediately upon the recognition of the fact, if the moment we realize what is necessary, we do that which we realize, there will be no build-up. There will be no vast patterns of regrets. There will be no broken hearts lasting through the years. What is necessary is next. What is finished is finished. What is no longer creative is no longer useful. What no longer helps is no longer necessary. Everywhere, simple, firm solutions. Even if we're not entirely sure, do the best we can and be prepared to stand by the consequences if we are wrong. But make simple, direct solutions. If the thing we are doing is obviously bad for us, stop doing it. If we will take these simple, direct attitudes, we will also discover, as some have found who have tried it, that our world will not fall apart, that our economic condition will not collapse, that we will not be sitting around unemployable as we would like to think. For our tensions create more unemployable people than our convictions ever will. Actually, the moment we clarify, we have more energy for the job. The moment we learn to do things thoroughly, quietly, and immediately, without regrets, when at work our mind is on the job instead of elsewhere, things solve themselves. Things straighten out. There are fewer errors, fewer excuses necessary. And little by little, we find our lives falling into a gentle, orderly pattern. We have not lost a sense of humor. We have finally discovered it. We have learned that the real quality of humor is to laugh with life and not at people. This Zen gives us a new attitude of being. And this new attitude of being marks itself on our faces with this quiet look of peaceful security. It makes it more natural that we smile, because we can smile when we have no secret worries and secret fears. And when all our works are done openly, when our decisions are made frankly and immediately, we carry no burden of unfinished business to disturb our sleep. We sleep well, we eat well, we feel better, simply because our lives are in order. And in a time of tension, it is this simplification, this directness, this letting go of the dead, this making new relationships and new pacts with life itself, this getting away forever from sophistication, this recognition of simple value, and that we can never afford to violate the integrities of life. We get a few of these simple patterns down, we will not have pressures as we know them. We will not have these neurotic frustrations. We will have quiet, even living with an opportunity to get a depth insight into life. For depth brings with it the love of beauty, the love of art, the love of culture, the love of all the fine things that make life worthwhile. So Zen has something to offer to us even in the West. And I hope in the course of this series of talks we will be able to examine some of these offerings in greater detail. At this time, I think we should all give thanks that the lecture is over and go home.